deep in the heart of the Welsh valleys, a young man had a deceptively young and unfathomably handsome man had decided that it was his destiny to become the greatest dog agility handler the world had ever seen. So he set about learning his craft. His front crosses were crisper than a dry December morning in the Brecon Mountains. His catchkers were slicker than a boiled pigeon in a rubber tube sock. The intensity, accuracy and speed and natural flamboyance he brought far surpassed anything the sport had ever seen and would ever likely see again. The time was approaching where he would be ready to shine on the world stage and begin his legacy. But he realized, to win any battle, you must first know your enemy.
Hello everyone, welcome along to today's podcast, and today's episode of Know Your Enemy is the wonderful Cale McCann. Cale's been a competitor in dog agility for multiple years and has been successful for all of them. She's also a business owner and her business is McCann Dogs, and she has a successful podcast as well. In this episode, I really enjoyed talking to Cale and hearing her opinion on lots of the things that I am interested in myself. Hopefully it is of interest to you too. Before we get into today's podcast though, I hope you'll just give me a moment of your time to tell you about the Karma Running Club. The Running Club is a course that is going to run for the entirety of the winter, from the end of October all the way through to the middle towards the end of March. The aim of the course is to help improve all of the areas that will allow you to be a better runner and a better partner for your dog in agility. In the course, we're going to work on strength, mobility, flexibility, core stability, balance, proprioception. We're going to work on acceleration, deceleration, change in direction, technique work, conditioning work. In essence, it's an overall program to improve all of the areas that you need to improve to become a better runner. 80% of the sessions can be done from home. The other 20% are running sessions, so you will need a little bit of space. But they are suitable for anyone because it's all about effort and it's all about doing what you can do. The registration for the group finishes next Tuesday. If you are interested or if you have any questions, feel free to send me a message. Thank you so much for your time. I hope you enjoy the podcast. Okay, welcome along again for another episode of Know Your Enemy. And this week we are fortunate enough to be joined by Cale McCann from Canada, an international level agility competitor and dog trainer. So Cale, do you want to say hello to everyone?
Hello, I'm super excited to be here and I love the name of your podcast.
Oh, thank you so much. And firstly, we haven't had someone with such a setup on the other side, so I think we're going to be, we're in for a treat today, I'm sure. So firstly, like I said, thank you so much for giving us some of your time today. We really appreciate it. I've introduced you, so we know your name. So Cale, who do you see yourself as today? How would you describe yourself?
Well, I'm many things, and I'm actually something a little different today than I was even 5 years ago. Most people that are probably listening to this know me as an agility competitor. I've done agility for a really long time. I started actually when I was like 7 years old, so very, very long time now. Done lots of agility, but in the recent years, I've slowly sort of integrated to take over my family's dog training business. So we have like a family dog training school here in Ontario, Canada. And in the last 5 years, I've really split my time between business owner, manager, all of those things, and then the peaceful heavenly side of agility that I get to go to and take a break away from crazy work stuff, which is good, not complaining. So I sort of have like two things. But then on top of that, I'm like a big believer of like not being like a soul. Like I work in dogs, my hobby is dogs. So I also need to make sure I do like non-dog stuff as well. So maybe I'm multifaceted, I'm not too sure, but I need that split so that I can feel sane. I'm sure other people can feel my pain.
Yeah, no, I definitely know what you mean. Sometimes you need to take yourself away, even if it is something that you love, just to make sure you're enjoying life as well at the same time.
Totally.
So you've got lots of different hats. You wear lots of different hats. What would you say your favorite is? Are you more of a competitor? Are you more of a trainer? Would you lean towards being a business owner? Where do you think your priorities lie at the moment?
Well, my priority has to be with the business, but if I could choose, it would definitely be training. I love training my dogs. I absolutely love it. I also love competing for sure, but, I don't compete that often. I really like to train my dogs. I find it to be, a great stress relief. It's a good escape. It's enjoyable. It's social sometimes. It's just, yeah, it's my absolute favorite thing to do. I could train all of the time if my time and my dogs would allow it.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, it's cool to hear that you really enjoy that side of it. I know myself personally, I really enjoy training my dogs, but I love the competition. And, you know, some different things fuel each of us. So it's always good to hear where you're coming from particularly. Now, you said that you've been in kind of the dog world since you were kind of seven. Is that right?
Yeah.
So what kind of got you into it then? And was it straight into agility or did you find your way in through some other means?
So my parents started our business like 40 years ago. And so when I grew up in a dog training household. So the very first things that I was exposed to was like competitive obedience and just like basic skill things. And like as a kid, we have a lot of property here and I would like walk our 15 dogs with my dad around our acreage. Like I just sort of was around a bunch of dogs all of the time. So I kind of picked up just like basic training things. And then at the time, my parents were really heavy into competitive obedience, but also flyball. They actually are one of the people who originated flyball in Canada, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, that's
cool. So I grew up on that. Yeah, it's super cool. And then they also were doing agility, but way back then, we're talking like 1983, 1984, 1985, 1986, agility wasn't really anything close to what it's like now. But I did start doing agility competitions when I was six. But the main thing that kind of got me into agility is our business did we traveled and did like entertainment shows at like fairs. And then we would go out to like the Calgary Stampede and like a bunch of different things. Like kind of like there's a group here called Super Dogs that's sort of in North America.
Yeah, I'm good at it.
Yeah, so it was kind of like that. So my first exposure to agility was doing these entertainment shows to music. And like, it was just like this big thing with like all kinds of people watching. And I don't think I obviously didn't realize it at the time because I was a kid. But now when I look back, I think like how lucky was I to run like we do like four or five shows a day. And like, there's a bit of pressure because we stack the order. So every dog that goes is like a bit faster than the next. There's thousands of people watching. And so as a kid, it was kind of normal to me to run under pressure with like lots of people watching. And I just sort of, I never really thought it was like that big of a deal because I was just so used to it. And then as I got older and started to get more competitive in agility, I actually looked back and thought like, wow, that was like really good schooling for myself. And I didn't really realize it at the time. So that sort of morphed into like doing things a bit more competitively as time went on. But originally I was just kind of playing around and having fun with it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. The last conversation I had with someone and we were kind of discussing how prior to getting into agility, they were an athlete and competing at a high level in their chosen sport and how that was beneficial. Because obviously, like you said, becoming used to that level of pressure and being able to perform under the pressure. And I guess even though you're not talking about coming in from a sport, you're still having to perform. I mean, I think that's so advantageous. So the amount of people who I see in agility and, you know, they might be fantastic dog trainers and in practice, they're brilliant. They can't do anything but a clear run. But then it comes to the competition day and they just cannot put it together because they can't cope with the pressure. I think it's a massive part of being good at dog agility is how much you can hold it together, right? And like you've had that experience.
Yeah, I can't agree with you more. I played, my dad's really into sports. He just turned 70 and he still plays hockey, baseball and pickleball. Like he's like really into sports. So when I was a kid, I also played sports as well. So competitive baseball, hockey, volleyball, swimming, that type of stuff. And it is so true. Like when you play sports that you're sort of like singular, like on your own, but then also even though agility is kind of a single sport, like it's just you and your dog in a way, there's a lot of like group elements to it. And I definitely see like from my own experience playing team sports, that's helped immensely for dog training, but I also know, like, as a coach, I can see people that come in, and even if it's like their first couple weeks in like foundation agility, I'll often say like, hey, did you play sports when you were younger? Because you can just tell, like, either how they move or
how easy they are to be coached as well, right? That's making a difference. Yeah,
totally. Yeah, it's a huge advantage. I mean, people can learn about that as they go on, but I think that coming into this sport with that can be really helpful.
Yeah, for sure. I 100% agree with you as well. I don't teach very much because I'll be honest, I'm not a massive fan of it. I don't like the teaching side of agility. I get quite frustrated.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, I love coaching humans. I've got a lot of time for that. That's obviously, but I don't know why. I don't know if it's because I see things a little bit more to a level that perhaps some people don't want to see it, and I am not able to dumb down my coaching, if that makes sense.
It does make sense.
Yeah, so I just kind of... I leave it. I do one or two groups of people who have I've kind of taught for a long time, and I still teach them because they ask. Yeah. But yeah, I've kind of pulled back on that side of things. So I always say, anyone who coaches, fair play to you, because it does take a lot of patience. And I know it also takes a lot of energy, right? By the end of a day of teaching, I bet you're absolutely quashed.
Yeah, sometimes you feel like a little bit like a therapist. Like, we're about to leave. I leave in a couple of days to like a big Canadian national championship on the other side of the country. And as like a whole bunch of my students are going, and everyone's like, okay, Cal, like, what's your pep talk for us? And I think, okay, got to put my therapist hat on and get everybody fired up. But yeah, it definitely is. It's a different side of agility for sure. I really love it, but I also know that it's not for everyone. Sometimes you just want to like do your own thing. Yeah. And I also, like when you said that you sometimes just want to like say what you think and not everybody's ready to perceive that, I definitely struggle with that myself sometimes, because it always comes from a good place. Like, I really want them to do the best. And sometimes being in it for so long and having a lot of experience, you see things. Like, sometimes I hate knowing so much because I look at things and be like, oh, there's so much I could say. And then I have to think to myself, how many things do they want to hear from me? Do I need to give them like two tips, or can I give them all 15 that I'm thinking about in this moment? So yeah, sometimes it's all about delivery, but I definitely sympathize with you with that comment for sure.
Yeah, and it's like you said as well, you know the things, but sometimes people come to do agility because they want the social, which is absolutely fine as well, right? You know, it's a big part of why a lot of people do it, and I think that's a really good side. But as a coach, you need to recognize that with the different people, and I can recognize it. I'm not okay with it though, so I just leave it there. So I think I know the answer to this because you kind of touched on it at the start. When you initially got into your dog training or dog agility, whichever side of it that you want to talk about, who was kind of like a big mentor for you? Who did you learn from in the first place?
Yeah, definitely my parents for sure, about like basic dog training, and at the time agility as well, because, you know, there was really no crazy hot shots in agility at that time in our country anyways. So definitely from them. And then as time went on, there was like a few people, like my parents started to do it a little bit less because they had three kids and they were busy. And then I ended up tagging on with like a couple of the people that taught for us that were really getting into agility. And I always joke, there's one girl, she doesn't do agility anymore. Her name's Robbie Stevenson. And back in the day, like, I was always enamored with how she handled her dogs because she was very smooth moving and she was like a really good dog trainer and she was really particular. And she was also like very kind to her dogs. And like, I really liked what she was doing. So as like 10 years old, 12 years old, I would like just sit in the back of the hall and like a creeper and just watch her train. And she was so nice to me. Then she would take me to competitions. And so that was really fun when she was young, when I was a lot younger. And then of course, as time went on and I started to kind of develop my own little thing. Then we often joke is like the people who coach me and then I turn around and now I would coach them because, you know, things shift over time. I'm sure lots of people do that. But I did a lot of observing when I was younger. I also did a lot of observing, like when I started to get better, like in my own country, and I started to realize that there was a lot of like great handlers and different agility elsewhere. I did a lot of watching YouTube videos. And, you know, when Facebook came, that was awesome. Instagram, you just sit and you watch other people handle. Because, I mean, our country is, it's big in size, but it's really little in terms of like our sport. And so if you want to grow, you kind of, and we have a great country for sure, but you kind of got to get out and you got to look at different things to get inspired. So, you know, I trained with lots of different people. I'm a big believer in like, I don't ever want to like cap myself out. So, you know, even though I'm pretty good at it, I always want to keep learning and I want to be challenged and I want to learn from different people. So I'm always watching things that I, you know, people's handling skills or training skills or movement. I really like that. Like I like to, you know, try to bring in different styles so that I can, you know, move really well with my dog, all of that kind of stuff. But I'm definitely an observer. And then I kind of put my own little like spin on it kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, and what you say then is mean is probably critical to the fact that you are, and one of the reasons that you are at the top of your game in Canada and in the world as well, is the fact that you are constantly looking to try and improve, because the minute you think you know everything, that's the moment you start getting overtaken. So, I mean, you've got to have that growth mindset, which, you know, you clearly have. And as you said, then, you know, agility is changing rapidly at the moment. And for Canada as well, I've seen you guys compete in the last few years on the international stage. And I'd say generally the standards are improving from both North America countries, America and Canada. So what do you put that down to?
I think that they're in the like international pool of trainers and handlers here. I think that everybody really, really wants to get better. And I think that everybody's really trying to make a lot of effort to allow ourselves to train more international stuff so we get more experience, because our issue is that in our local competitions, the styles of courses are nothing like what we would do overseas when we're competing. Yeah. I don't know whether you experienced something like that or not with where you live, but with us, we would compete on all these different styles of courses that were not really open and flowy and that type of thing. And then we would go overseas, not have a lot of experience competing with that style. And then like we would get just wrecked over there because we just didn't have the experience. So I think the biggest change now is we have organizations like UKI here that's a little bit more tailored toward international, which has been really helpful. But we're always putting on like our own events that are unsanctioned. I used to run this event called Big Bucks Biathlon, where people would come and they would put money and we would set up like international courses and compete to win cash so that we had a bit of pressure, but nobody was getting any titles. But the thing is, we don't care about that.
Yeah.
We care about running under pressure on hard courses and just getting our feet wet with that. So when we go over, it feels like home. It feels like something we're comfortable with. So I think that's the biggest thing that's different now with our country. But and there's more people that are interested in training at this level, which is super exciting. There's still a huge group of people that do not give two shits about international. And I think they don't really like us that much because maybe we're a little intense. But yeah, I would say that's the biggest difference. But
yeah,
it's hard to, like, you have a lot of organizations and there's some organizations that have like different levels and quality of dogs that come from it. So there's some teams that go over that do really well because they have a lot of the top handlers on it. And then there's other Team Canadas that go over that aren't as good because they have less experienced people, but you give them two or three more years and then they'll be a lot better. So there's like kind of some developmental ones, and then people who have like just been doing it for a long time. So
it comes back to kind of what we touched on at the start about the experience in competition is going to help you progress forward. And even though, like when we spoke about yourself having that experience in performing, even though that wasn't in competition, that allowed you then to excel in agility. Well, that's actually mm-hmm. what's taking agility onwards as well. I agree with you in like Canada and America, now you are becoming more familiar with having to compete on these types of courses regularly under that pressure. That's conducive with the progress that you're finding. And we are in a similar situation in the UK. I would say generally our regular courses are nothing like what we see when we compete internationally. But same as you guys, things are changing for the better. And I think for all three of our countries, I think we can say that we're getting closer, closing the gap, if you will. We talked to you about being a trainer. If you are a trainer, how long do you feel it takes you to work out if someone is going to be successful as a competitor? How quick can you spot it, do you think? I'm interested in this one because I feel like you can see it straight away.
Yeah, I can see it usually pretty early on. And to be honest with you, I often will have a conversation with them about that early on as well, because then it allows me to adapt my coaching tactics.
Yeah.
Because sometimes I find, because I am an overachiever, I have really high expectations. That's just my nature. I want to be careful that I don't put that on somebody who doesn't care about it. Yeah. But if I know that like you're even thinking about it, then I'm going to be more nitpicky with you. I'm going to make you think about big picture. So I try to do that early. However, there have been some people that have surprised me. Like they'll start off with maybe a dog that isn't really international caliber, and they kind of get their feet wet, but they, you know, compete enough that they sort of go, okay, I think I like this. And then their next dog, they have like a totally different sense. And then you're like, okay, you're ready now. You're ready to take this a little bit more seriously. So yeah, usually it's pretty quick. But sometimes there's people who are slow burns, and I think that's kind of exciting.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, they catch you by surprise. But again, let's put your training hat on now then. And for someone who comes to you and says, I want to take it as far as I can then, you know, whatever that might be, what is the one thing that you see as a trainer that a lot of people are doing that you think is something that could be such an easy fix, but it's like you just see so many people doing it and they don't realize that they're making the mistake?
Can I say something so freaking simple?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. My biggest bugaboo with people training is reward placement.
Yeah.
Reward placement. It is so fucking simple. It is a simple concept. But do you think people, number one, can train their dog to bring a toy back to them? Number two, throw the toy at the right time? And number three, throw the toy in the right place? If you literally were able to do those three things, you would fix forward motion. You would fix collection. You would fix running contacts, you would fix weave pole entries, you would fix independence, you would fix commitment. There's like so many things, because I find people come and they're like, okay, I need help with this, this, and this, and this. And then my quick fix with it would be like, okay, well, let's, you know, reward the toy here or put the toy there. And they're like, oh, I can't do that. He'll run away with the toy. Or yeah, my dog, like, it's like, we could literally fix this in 5 minutes, but it's like, people's expectation is they want to do the thing, but then they don't want to do like the little basic things that make the thing really easy. And I think that it comes from like my dog training background, or like start lines, or like self-control. I have a lot of the dogs that I end up training myself are very, very high-minded to a fault sometimes. So I've really learned a lot about like how important basics are and like maintaining good like mental state and that type of thing. Because if they're not going to be able to hold start line, how on earth are they going to collect when I ask them to, or whatever, right? So it's the dog training that comes back. But yeah, like that's, I could literally go on all day about all the things that irritate me about things. But reward placement, it's such a simple concept, but people don't take it seriously enough, and you can get a completely different style of agility dog if you reward them the right way.
Yeah, I'm going one step further on something that is, to be honest, unbelievable that people don't even know what it is: reward structure. When I'm teaching, I used to go on to people about like reward structure and explaining to me their criteria. And I thought, like, you know, maybe I could help you kind of clarify that, clean it up a bit. And they're like, oh, what's a reward structure? And I'm like, how are we at this point if you don't even know what a reward structure is? It's kind of, yeah, it's some people get to a place, and I don't think it's by luck, but equally, I do think it's by luck. I'm not going to lie. I just think, Jesus Christ, how the hell have you managed to get this far and not know what a reward structure is?
Well, or sometimes they just get like a really good dog and they're like a one-hit wonder. So their dog ends up being able to like decipher their crappy training. But then when they get the next dog, that dog maybe isn't as forgiving, and they have to learn about like dog training and how to unlock that, what that dog needs. But you're right, like the reward structure is so important. Or like people who either have poor criteria, or like, you seem like, I don't know you well, but you seem like you'd be like really animated with your dogs. I'm like over the top with my dogs. But that's another thing I find, like sometimes when dogs do something right or okay or wrong, people's response is like almost the same.
Yes.
Or like another beef that I have is when people give their dogs like I'm sorry rewards. So like they'll do something wrong and then the dog goes off course, or like the dog enters the weepholes and they shouldn't or whatever, and they're like, oh, nice try, and they give the dog a toy. And then I'm like, and then they do the sequence again, and the dog enters the wheeze and looks at them like, yeah? And they're like, why did he do that? You just gave him the toy on the last one for doing it.
Yeah.
But they just don't see that. And if you could just learn a little bit more about like how dogs think and like how you could reward, like the dogs, they don't make as many mistakes because you make sense to them.
Yeah. But the other one that I get that gets me as well, because we're on this, I just wanted to bring this up so that hopefully no one ever does.
Sorry, everybody. We love you.
The one where someone is, like you say, training their dog, and their dog doesn't do something right, and they don't understand how like their tone and their pitch of their voice. So like the dog will do something right and they reward, and they're like, oh, well done, good dog, well done. And they're like playing with it, blah, blah, blah. Next time they do something again and the dog does it wrong, and they're like, oh my God, never mind, don't worry, let's do it again. And I'm like, that's the exact same thing. You've literally done the exact same thing to your dog, and they've done the wrong command as when you rewarded them. I was like, how the hell are you meant to know that it was right or wrong? And like the misconception of, I think people misunderstand positive reinforcement.
Yes.
And they want to praise them all the time, when obviously that's not what positive reinforcement is. I think we're going down an alleyway. We'll pull back from this, Kayle. Yeah. I think we're gonna be here ranting all day otherwise. So let's go back to your competitive side then. At the moment now, how many dogs are you competing with?
This is gonna be a shocker, but just one.
Just the one, right? Beeline, right?
Yeah. Okay. Beeline, yeah. I do have a young dog.
Do you want to tell us about the young dog a little bit?
Yeah. He'll be two in a couple months. And he's not really ready to compete quite yet. Like maybe in like jumps and tunnel classes and things like that. But I think he's going to be really cool. He's a little whippet, staffy, border collie, terrier mixture.
Yeah.
But he's really cool. And he's, I thought because he's similar size and similar like drive to be, that I thought that I could kind of like step into like new shoes and like just, it would be comfortable. But that is not the case. He is definitely very different. And it's kind of been cool though, because I've been kind of learning that I need to like adapt myself a bit more. I Bee will be seven in a month or so. And I definitely feel comfortable with her now. Like I know my timing, and like we're a team now, which is really great. And I said this to somebody last night, because I had Bee in class, and I was like, and I had done a similar drill with Five, my puppy, before. And with Bee, it was just so easy. And I was like, gosh, like when you get a puppy, you feel so grateful for how well trained your older dog is, because it's like It's just such a new experience. But I will say, I'm someone that used to compete with a lot of dogs. Like for a long time, I actually competed with 4 dogs. And I loved it at the time. But now that I have a busier life and there's just more going on, I actually really love competing with just 2 dogs will probably be perfect, because I feel like I can devote my whole attention to her. And it sort of happened accidentally. I did have a couple dogs at the time, and a few years ago my high competition dog died really young of cancer, which was really sad. Don't want to go down that road, because start crying. But so that was tough. And at the time, B was only 2, and so she wasn't really ready to compete, but she was still training. And so I think as like a way to soothe myself, I just kind of dove into B like completely. And it was great, because she just really got good fast, because she had my sole attention. And I kind of realized that I liked that. So so anyways, it's nice having the 2 dogs, but they are very different. And it will probably be a challenge once I get going, but I like that. Like, I'm excited for that. I'm not like, that kind of gets me like fired up a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. So what do you think are some future goals for them? And it doesn't need to be competition related, but equally it can be.
Well, my goal is to, with B, I want to try and have a few more like really good international years with her, because she is in her prime. And then with my puppy, what I'm excited about having multiple dogs is when I have all these big competitions, like I have 2 world championships, all these national things with B. So she really has to be at the forefront of my focus with training. So I find that my puppy's training, it kind of goes, and then like there's this a lull, and then it goes, and then there's a lull. So like there's some things, like he doesn't even know how to do a teeter totter yet. Like he knows a little bit, but I'm excited for when like competition season's over for B, and I can like really put some blood, sweat, and tears into my puppy. Cause then next year I feel like I can actually like run him for real at competitions. So that's, I'm really looking forward to that. And maybe a big event by like the end of next year is kind of like my loose goal for him.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think it's different. You have competition goals for dogs that kind of know stuff. And then when you have like puppies, I have more like short-term goals, like, you know,
they need
sequencing
to be
my running dog well, walk.
They need to be like shorter term, so that you're constantly hitting them, and then you keep that motivation. Because with a with a young dog, there's so much to do. If you look too far ahead, it can be a bit demotivating.
So much to do. Totally.
So in dog agility, then, like you said, you're looking at a couple more international competitions. Is there anyone internationally who you really enjoy watching or respect as a dog trainer or as a competitor? Who do you like to follow, kind of thing?
Yeah, there's a few people. I mean, this won't be a surprise, but obviously I now have like a lovely connection with Dave Munnings and Dan Shaw. So, and that's one of the things that drew me to Dave in the first place. Like before I even knew him, I saw him at WAO and I loved how he trained his dogs, but I loved how he ran his dog, excuse me. But I also liked how he trained his dogs.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes when you watch people out with their dogs, you see people, you can kind of tell people that are agility competitors and then people who are also like trainers at the same time, because they're almost training their dogs as they're competing. I see this with Dave. I see that with like Teresa. She's really good at that. Nicola Guardi from Italy, he's really good at that as well. Lisa Frick. I'm very close to Jaakko Swignudi from Finland, Janita from Finland. Like, they're dog trainers who also happen to be really great at agility. And there's probably like way more than what I'm naming.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, there's loads out there.
I feel bad. But
to see who you are kind of tuned in with.
Yeah.
You know,
what I'm attracted to. I'm attracted to people who are into like the training bit of it. And also I like when I notice how they treat their dogs, because that's really important to me as well. And I don't mean like they need to treat their dog like sunshine and roses all the time. Like, I like when you can see they have good criteria. And I also like when like they're genuinely happy when like their dog gets a hard weave entry and they're like, and then they keep running, and like they can do that and they're at a big competition. Like, that's what I like to do with my dogs. I love that, because you can see like there's a different bond going on with their dog than just like the average person. It's very attractive. I like that.
Yeah, for sure. I do get what you mean as well. The ability to see past the competition, and because, like, you know, they might have worked on that weave entry for however long to get it, and that kind of means more than the actual competition almost sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah.
What about judges then? Are there any judges that you really look out for whose courses you like the challenge of?
Yeah, quite a few. I would think the top of my list, I really, really like Tomas Tri's course. I'm sure he's probably a crowd favorite of most. I really like his courses, and I really gained like a lot more respect from him a few years ago. He was here in Canada, and he did like a course design workshop that I attended, and it was fascinating. Like, I really love course design. I'm a bit of a psycho. I have I teach classes every week, and every single week I make brand new lesson plans. Like, it takes me hours every single week, but I love the course. Like, it's so stupid. I could just reuse things. I've been teaching it for so long, but I like the design part of it. And I picked up so many great things from that workshop, and just I look at course maps a lot on Facebook and stuff, and I have albums of them on my phone. I like seeing trends. I study judges before I compete with them. I look at all their maps and kind of see if there's like similar things that come up. But Tomas would be someone for sure. I mean, there's lots of other people. I mean, there's certain ones that I shy away from, and there's certain ones
that's a good point as well. Not all judges are something to look forward to, should we say?
No, not always. But I mean, I think it's getting better overall.
Yeah, I think so too. I think I've said this a couple of times. I think at one point this year, it felt like all the judges were trying to outdo each other. And there were some courses coming out that I was trying to prep for the EOs. And it was like, what the hell is this? It was like, I love a challenge. I don't necessarily need to go clear to enjoy the course. I enjoy the challenge, right? But some of the courses, and I've said it to a few different, like, they were so relentless that it was like stressful. And I was like, I don't know if I'm enjoying this anymore. There's like, you're trying to get over there to do a skill, and there's like 14 things in the way. And it's, it was like, oh my God. And I just felt like they were trying to outdo each other with how difficult they were. And things were starting to not flow as well because stuff was in the way. But I would say I'm glad they've kind of, it feels like they've reined it back in, and it's at a level now where it's still challenging, obviously challenging the skills at speed, but it is more fun again, I think.
Yeah, I think that agility has really changed. Like, I found like last year, it would be interesting to know whether you see these trends in England as well, but I find like last year it was like all kinds of like different throttles were like the big thing. Yeah. And then this year I feel like it's layering.
Yeah.
And there's so much stuff in the way where you have to be like, hey, do I run this side? Do I run that side? Like, yeah, there's shit everywhere on the course. And it's becoming a little bit more normal. And sometimes the judges nail it, and it's like very well thought out, and it's very doable. But it's hard, like not easy, if you're in the right place at the right time, and then it actually flows like beautifully.
Yes.
And then there's other times I think where like they're trying to get a layer, but it just doesn't hit right. And then it's too like choppy. I don't know. It's hard to explain, but that's definitely the trend that we're seeing for sure.
So one thing that I agree with you on all that you said, but and like one of the easiest ways to force a layer is to put the tunnel under the dog walk, right? And split the handler from the dog doing that. Now, I get that. That isn't, I don't want to say an easy way, because I'm not trying to like undermine planning and all that kind of thing, but that's a fairly natural way to force a layer, right? But because of that, I feel like that trend has been played to death. And like, I've done so much this year, it feels like, where it's like, send your dog to a tunnel the other side of the dog walk and layer the other side. And it's like, let's move on a little bit now. Let's come up with something different. I mean, I'm all for agility moving forward in whatever direction it is, but I feel the judges play a main part in that because they are setting the skills. And when one judge clocks onto something, oh, that's cool, and then they try and go their own way to do it, I just want to see some layering options away from a dog walk now. And there are some.
Yeah.
There definitely are some, but I just feel like a lot of judges kind of go back to that tunnel under a dog walk, lose your layer. And it's like, right, okay, we got this again. Okay, no problem. Let's do it. But yeah, I think that definitely has been a trend this year, like you say, for sure.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you.
So let's move more into the real life questions now. And I say it like that because obviously agility is still a big part of your life, as it is for most of the people listening to this podcast, I would assume. But what do you think people misunderstand about you the most, Kale?
I think that if you don't know me, you might not realize that I'm like a very, I'm a very silly, down-to-earth person. And I find like people say that to me, and it always surprises me when people say that to me. They think like, oh, you're like, they always say like, you're so normal, or what is normal, by the way, but you're so like, whatever. I think maybe when you see somebody who is doing well, or like I'm a fairly fierce and serious competitor, but also like I can have a good time too.
Yeah.
So I don't know, that might be what people misunderstand about me a little bit, but I don't know. I feel like I would want to ask other people.
Yeah, that's probably the easiest way to find out. Yeah. But like what you just said then, I think it's really common, isn't it? It's like you have that competitive edge and you're able to kind of flip the switch and it's like, right, I'm in competition mode now. So yeah, I might not appear the most friendly, but that doesn't mean that you aren't. It just means that at the time when most people see you, I guess, you're in that mode. So yeah, I totally get what you're saying there. I mean,
yeah,
it makes sense.
Yeah, I think you can like have like a professional hat and you can have like a competitive hat. And then you can also like have like your silly hat. And like I learned from years of competing that I always do better at competitions if I'm a little bit more relaxed, because like that's how we train. Like when we train, we have our group of people, like we're obnoxious, like we're so silly and we're joking around and like we're competitive and we're serious for sure, but it's just a little bit more chill. And then like I train my dog well and I run well because I'm just like, you know, I'm in that mode. And like, I remember years ago, this is sort of a funny story, but one of my very first world championships, it was IFCS and it was in, I don't remember, Holland or something like that. And I was 19 or 20. So in Canada, you have to be 19 to drink. So I hadn't really been drinking that long.
Yeah.
And we were at World Championships and there was like this banquet like the night before, and I had a couple glasses of wine and I was like just being really silly and like a little bit whatever, a little bit crazy. And we got up to the competition the next morning and I can't believe like how many people like from other countries was like, hey, like how are you feeling today? Like they thought like I was like gonna be hungover, which I wasn't really. I didn't really drink that much. I think I'm just loud and bubbly and that type of thing.
Yeah.
And then I ended up doing really well that weekend, which was awesome. And my mom actually said to me, she's like, you've done a good job this weekend of like being your silly thing, but then also being competitive. Because I think for me, if I get too in my head and I'm like too serious, I put too much pressure on myself and then I'm not having as much fun. Yeah. Everybody's different. So like, some people might need to like really focus and like kind of get away from those distractions and that might work well for them. But for me, for sure, I need to let loose a little bit. And then I always do better because I'm just a little bit more chill.
Yeah, for sure. It makes sense. What are you most proud of then? It's funny how people always struggle to answer this question. Honestly, this is the one question and they're like, oh, I don't know. I'm not sure what it is. But yeah, what do you
think? Yeah, I think I was struggling with like what direction to go, because I think the obvious choice would be to like list my accolades and say like, oh, I'm a 21-time world champion. But like for me, it's more like I think I'm more proud that I've been able to do this for as long with as many dogs, because I think it speaks to my dog training and my ability that way, because it's not just been like one or two dogs. I've had like 7 or 8 dogs on world teams now for like years and years and years. And so I think for me, like whether I win stuff or not, like I I feel good about the fact that I've been able to learn from each dog and then make adjustments for the new dog that I get. And then I've had different breeds too. I've learned a lot along the way to kind of bring into kind of how I want to do things. So I don't know. I think I feel more proud of that than the accolade part. That's great. Cool. But I don't know. I just think the other part of it is more.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, the fact that you're able to replicate the achievements with multiple dogs, it goes to say that, you know, your skills as a dog trainer don't just land on one dog. It's the ability to work with multiple dogs. So talking on the other end of the spectrum then is what do you see as kind of your biggest failure? And then what did you learn from it?
I would say, I don't know if this is a failure because it really was growth, but like when I was younger, I had to really grow up in the spotlight in agility because I was quite good very young. And also when I was very young, I didn't know about, you know, sportsmanship or not putting too much pressure on my dogs or, you know, my behavior in certain situations because I was 15, 16. And I find sometimes there I would make poor choices about getting mad after a run because it went shitty. And I didn't, it would affect my dog. It would affect how people would look at me because I would be unnecessarily irritated about things. And so I often, like, as I got older, I felt like I was being judged a lot, and I felt like I had to do a bit of work to show people that I had grown as a person. And I think when I look back at it, I wish that, like, I have a young junior handler that trains with me right now, and she's 17 years old, and it's, I really have embraced her because I see myself in her because she's getting so much better. But when she first started, she would be like, she'd cry after she would like knock a bar in a run and things like that. And I think like, no, like there's so much more to this. But like when you're that young and you haven't really learned about that kind of stuff yet, you can't control your emotions as well. And then that affects your dog and all of those types of things. So I don't know. I think if I think about failures, I don't really think it's a failure, but it's something that I look back and I think like, gosh, I wish I had figured it out sooner.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like now I can be a good mentor to like other people about that. But yeah, I still kind of think about that because, you know, as you get older and you know how much like your attitude is important towards your dogs and towards like the people around you, especially as somebody who like you get watched a lot, like people can't wait to see you, you know. They like to see you do well, but they sure like to see you do something wrong. So you kind of have to be careful. And that's hard when you're younger and you don't understand that and that you aren't able to kind of, you know, be more aware of your emotions. So I don't know if that's a good answer. But
yeah, no, it is a good answer. And I think the thing that's important to understand, and like, you know, you obviously you understand it now, but like most people who are in agility are either older or have that experience, but they learn about all those things that you're talking about at that age when you were in agility. So unfortunately, at the point when you were in agility, that's when you were learning about those things. And obviously, as someone who's competing at a high level from that time, you're in the spotlight straight away and you haven't learned those things. So you're learning it in the spotlight. So, you know, it can't be easy. And I understand why, you know, you might see it as a failure, but as I say, and that's kind of what we're talking about in this section is, you know, everyone has done things that perhaps wasn't as they'd have liked it to be. But as long as you learn from it, then you can kind of keep growing. And it's like you say, for yourself, you were so young at that time that that's when most people would have learned that particular lesson. You just so happened to learn it in the public eye, so to say.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's lots of like training things that I probably screwed up like a long time ago. And there's probably training things I'm probably going to screw up, you know, in years to come, because that's like kind of part of it. But if you think like sort of bigger picture, that's sort of something that I think is important to reflect on.
Yeah, for sure. I can see where you're coming from. I can see where you're coming from. So what in dog, I don't know if we do dog training because we've kind of talked about the training side of things, but what makes you mad in competition? What do you see that really annoys you?
Do you mean like with myself or like other people or
People or yourself? Yeah, it doesn't even have to be in agility. I mean, a lot of people have answered about road rage kind of things in this particular section, but yeah.
Well, if it's with agility, there's like a couple things that I get really frustrated with. Number one, if the people who are putting on the competition don't take like safety and things like that, and they don't feel like that's as important as it should be, that really irritates me, especially when it's like at a competition that I really need to do or want to do. And then I'm kind of like in a situation where like they don't have enough tunnel bags on, or like the approach to the dog walk shitty, and they're not open and receptive to like adapting to that. Although I find that that's getting better. That's something that I don't like. And the other thing that I don't like is, I find this really frustrating, is when I'm watching people run their dogs and they get so irritated with their dogs about things when it is 1000% their fault.
Yeah.
Like I either want to run away and hide, or I want to kick them in the teeth when they come out, because it's, and then like when you see the dog react to that, like that really bugs me. Or if like it's just going so badly and people just either don't pull the plug, or they just get so mad, like I can't, sometimes I have to say to like people under my breath, like I can't watch this. Like it's literally making my temperature raise right now. Like it drives me crazy. And that must be like the coaching and dog training side of me coming out, but I hate that. It's so annoying.
I know that when they're blaming the dog and you're like, you're not even like, I always say to the people who I, when I used to do more training, and they're like, oh, I don't understand why my dog is doing X, Y. And I'm like, first thing you should do is watch your video, turn the volume off, and try and
see
what you're asking for, because you might be verbally saying something, but look what you're showing physically. Yeah. And then secondly, if you are verbally saying something and you're facing the right way and your dog doesn't do it, then it's still your fault because you haven't
taught it better enough.
Yeah, exactly. All right. We'll come away from that before we go on to another rant, and we're going to move into the quick fire round now. So you don't need to take too much time with any background, but just for people to get a little bit more of an understanding of, you know, who you are. So what did you have for breakfast?
This is really bad, but I've only eaten a banana today, and it's 12:41 p.m.
Oh, that's not so bad.
Normally I'm like a fried egg sandwich girl, and I make like a really, really delicious one.
Okay.
That's like my go-to. But today was just not that day.
No, yeah. What was the last thing you Googled?
How to download Skype.
Yeah.
For this call.
Makes sense. When did you last sing, and what song was it?
Oh, this is a hard one because I sing all the time.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm a singer at heart.
What's your karaoke song then?
Ooh, karaoke song. I have a couple, but I really like is it Black Horse in a Cherry Tree who's that song?
Oh, I know the song. I can't think who it's by, and I'm definitely not giving you a verse of it either. But yeah, I know the song you mean.
Yeah, I like that song. And I like a couple other songs though, but like singing is like another one of my like side passions. I used to sing like professionally, like when I was younger.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I love a good sing song, but I also like to sing badly.
Yeah. Well, that's more my world.
Yeah. And like, I like to sing about things that I see. So, and I like make songs up to people.
Okay.
And
so your life is like a bit of a musical then, maybe.
Yeah, and I love when people join me in those musical times.
Just kind of pick it up, nice. So you say you're musical. Yeah. Do you play any instruments?
I do. I should say I did. I before I discovered I could sing, I went through many instruments, like through school. I took a lot of music in school. And then I figured out about the whole singing thing, and I was like, well, I don't have to carry an instrument home. Yeah. I can just use myself. And so I actually, my very first instrument I learned was the baritone. Do you know what that is?
Yeah,
it's like a little tuba.
Yeah.
And I was like not a very big child, and bringing this like huge thing home to practice was pretty hysterical, but
I started learning the sax for a bit. I play a few different musical instruments. I still do.
Nice.
Yeah, I started learning the sax, but what I realized quite quickly was you cannot practice quietly.
No, you can, especially with that instrument.
Yeah, yeah. That's probably the only instrument I've ever started playing, and I was never proficient on it. I just was like, oh my
God. It's hard to play. Any reed instrument is hard to play.
Yeah, for sure. It was a challenging one. And I think I do genuinely put it down to the fact that I couldn't practice because my neighbors would have gone insane. But yeah, that was the one that I didn't really make any progress on. Do you believe in ghosts?
I don't think so.
No.
I'm like a point and shoot. Like I need a proof thing. Yeah. If I had proof, then I would be open to it, but I haven't had that. So no.
Yeah. I'm with you. Any tattoos?
Many.
Yeah. Okay. Any more planned?
I do have some planned, but I don't have like enough secured to like book an appointment quite yet, but I'm definitely not done. I love them.
Cool. Fair. Do they hurt?
Surprisingly, I would say they're more irritating than hurtful.
Depends where you have them done then.
Yeah, I have ones in different locations and some have been easier to sit for than others, but I don't know. I have a pretty low pain tolerance. And so if I can sit through getting a tattoo, anybody could do it.
The way I always describe it, it definitely depends on where, because I've got a couple that are on my ribs and that was horrific for the whole time that I had it done.
I have that too.
Yeah, that was rough. I always describe it as like, picture you've got sunburn and then a cat is scratching your sunburn. I think that's a good explanation of what a tattoo feels like.
I would completely agree with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. A scratchy burn.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, for sure. What
sounds great.
What superpower would you have if you could have any?
Ooh. Gosh. I'm not good at making decisions because I really like to think about them. Yeah. But off the cuff, I would say either to be like invisible so that I could go wherever I wanted, or to be able to like get to like a new spot in like just whenever I wanted to.
Teleportation.
Yes, that's right. That's what I was looking for.
Okay, so this last question is the one that I always leave to last. I've just said that you've got a superpower, but in this scenario, I've got a superpower as well. And my superpower is that I've got Dr. Doolittle vibes, and I'm able to allow you to have a conversation with your dogs. So if I gave you 10 seconds, what would you be telling them?
That's a cool question. I like that. I would love to have a conversation with my dogs because their personalities are so different. I feel like it would be really hysterical.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think this is cheesy, but like, I would want to know if there was like anything more that I could do to like make them happy.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
That could be like not doing stuff too. Like maybe there's things that I do that they're like, gosh, like I wish you wouldn't drag me to do this all the time. Yeah. Or maybe there's other things that they're like, yo, like pick it up a little.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Cool. We always make fun of I've got a young border pup and she's so sweet, but she doesn't give much away. She's really like, she's like super sweet, but not much with expressions. And you kind of have to guess how she's feeling. So that's why I came up with the question. I was always just thinking, God, I wish I could just speak to you for 10 seconds to say, are we good? Is everything cool? Or are we like, you know, I'm pretty sure she's happy, but you know, she doesn't seem to like mind anything we do. And she seems to have fun, but like her face is like serial killer levels of non-communication. Is mental. She's
which
like,
is funny because she's probably so cute.
Oh, she is.
At the same time.
Yeah, she totally gets away with it because, yeah, she like, she's expressionless, but it's just she's already cute. But like, you said, your dogs have like a natural character, or they'll have a face they put. She has no, She's got none of that. She just is.
That is so funny.
Yeah, she's got like that serial killer vibes of like just like death stare at you and that. But she's we absolutely love it. But that's where I got the question from. It's because I said to Amy, I was like, I just wish I could just speak to her for 10 seconds and just like, are we good? You know, are you happy? Yeah. So that's where that came from. Yeah, but that's us for now, Kayle. So thank you so much for giving us some of your time. I really enjoyed that. I'm sure everyone will as well. Before we go, is there anything that you want to make people aware of, anything that you want to plug or anything like that?
Yeah, sure. If you're a podcast lover, I have an agility podcast as well. It's called the McCann Dogs Agility After Class Podcast. And there's a little bit of training stuff on it, training advice and whatnot. But mostly we like to talk about like topics that other people don't like to talk about, such as like coach hopping or, you know, just things that, you know, from a trainer or coach perspective, or sometimes a handler's perspective, you know, those things that you gossip about with like your buddies, like after class, we like to like share those thoughts with everybody, which is kind of fun. We have a good time. So if you like podcasts, you like that. And then if you want to check out our school, it's McCann Dogs, and we have a pretty cool YouTube channel. We just got over 1 million subscribers last year, which is pretty cool. Dog training related. And then if it's agility stuff, just anything McCann Dogs agility, I'm all over socials. But yeah.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you again, Kayla. I really, really appreciate it. Do you want to say goodbye to everyone?
Bye, guys. Thanks a lot.
See you guys. And that is the end of the podcast. Thank you for taking some time out of your day to listen. I really hope you enjoyed. If you think you might know someone else who would enjoy, feel free to pass on all the information and share the podcast with them. And get involved on any of the social media platforms. It really helps the podcast grow, and I really appreciate it. See you in the next one.